rose to stalk away from the table and settle down not far from the Janosqua, who did not object. The two exchanged a very slight nod and began to speak in low voices in a language I did not recognize. I lowered the hammer carefully and put the revolver down. The table was silent for another long moment before Binder said in a jovial tone, as if he'd never stopped speaking, "So, Dara was in Belize with 30 monkeys, a panda, and the pygmy elephant." He had begun to tell a story that everyone around the table thought was completely fabricated, while he insisted that every detail was absolutely true, when Nicodemus entered the factory through emergency doors on the floor level, letting in a blast of freezing mist and winter air. He had added a long coat to his ensemble, and he dropped it behind him as he strode forward across the floor. His shadow slid over the floor beside him, too large and never quite in sync with the rest of him. "Good evening," he said as he took his seat at the head of the table. "Ladies and gentlemen, please give me your attention. Wizard Dresden, if you would, please give us a brief primer on the nature of ways and how they open." I blinked as every eye on the table turned to me. I said, "Ways are basically passages between the mortal world and some portion of the never-never, the spirit world. Any point in the mortal world will open a way to somewhere, if you know how to do it. The way opens to a place that shares something in common with the point of origin in the mortal world. For example, if you wanted to open a way to hell, you'd have to find a hellish place in the mortal world and start from there. If you want to go to a peaceful place in the never-never, you start with a peaceful place here. Like that. Chicago is a great place for ways. It's a crossroads, a big one. You can get just about anywhere from here." "Thank you," Nicodemus said. "Our goal is to open a way into the secured facility containing our objective." He accepted a large sheet of rolled paper from a squire who had hurried up to hand it to him. "Bearing all those factors in mind, I'm sure you'll understand why we will begin the job here." With a flick of his wrist, he unrolled the large sheet of paper. It proved to be blueprints, a floor plan. I frowned and stared at it, but it didn't look familiar. Karen made a choking sound. "Murph?" I asked. "Ah," Nicodemus said, smiling. "You know it." "It's a vault," Karen said, looking up at me. "A vault that belongs to a lord of the underworld." I felt myself clench up in a place that didn't bear much more clenching. "Oh," I said weakly. "Oh, hell's bells." Binder jerked a thumb at me. "What's he on about?" he asked Karen. Karen put a forefinger on the plans. "This is the Capristi building," she said. "It's the second most secure facility in the city." She took a deep breath. "It's a mob bank, and it belongs to Gentleman John Marcone, a courted baron of Chicago." Chapter 26. I'd been afraid it would come to something like this, though I'd held out hope that Nicodemus would come up with a better way of getting to where we needed to go. Like maybe burning down a building around our ears and hoping to open a way at the last second. That would have been merely dicey. Marcone was dangerous. Gentleman Johnny Marcone had clawed his way to the top of Chicago's outfit back when I had first set up business in town, and he had ruled the city's crime with an iron fist ever since, with an eye toward making organized crime safer, more efficient, more businesslike. It worked. A lot of cops thought he had more power than the government. Those cops kept their mouths shut about it for the most part, though, because he commanded more cops than the government, too. Then, a few years back, he'd sought and gained the title of Freeholding Lord under the Unseelie Accords, the legal document that was the backbone of civilized relations between supernatural nations. He was the first vanilla human being on record as having done so, and he had claimed, fought for, and held Chicago against all comers thus far as its baron. Though, to be fair, I'd been out of town for a lot of that time. Still, I didn't think it would be smart to cross him if I wasn't prepared to go right to the mat for keeps. Marcone commanded an army of thugs and hired killers, some of whom were truly excellent at their jobs. He kept a small squad of Einherjaren, dead but not gone Viking warriors, on retainer, and I'd seen them efficiently take on some of the toughest nasties I've ever encountered. He had at least one freaking Valkyrie on the payroll, and the man himself was ruthless, intelligent, and absolutely without fear. I thought getting into it with Marcone was going to be about two steps shy of getting into it with Hades himself. But all I said out loud was, "Oh boy." "Problem, Dresden?" Nicodemus asked. "Marcone is not someone to cross lightly," I said. "Not only that, but he's a member of the Accords."
"I'm not," Nicodemus said. "Not any longer."
"I am," I said, "twice. As a wizard of the White Council and as the Winter Knight."
"I'm sure the White Council will be stunned and disappointed should you not conform to their policy," Nicodemus said. "And as for Mab, you are in effect simply my tool during this operation. As far as she is concerned, any obligation you incur with regard to the Accords can be laid at my feet, not hers."
He was right, twice, which made me scowl. "My point is," I said, "Marcone is not a man to be taken lightly. If you hit him, he hits you back, harder."
"Indeed," Nicodemus said. "He has an excellent reputation. He would have made a fine monarch only a few centuries ago."
"Good King John Marcone?" I shuddered at the thought. "Let's say we hammer our way into his building," I said. "Fine, it's probably doable. Getting back out again is going to be the hard part. And even if we do that, it isn't over. He isn't going to forget or let it go."
"Dresden's right," Karen said. "Marcone doesn't suffer intrusions on his territory, period."
"We will do what we have come to do," Nicodemus said calmly. "If necessary, reparations to the Baron can be considered once our mission is accomplished. I believe I can make the point to him that accepting such restitution will be more cost-effective than pursuing more personal collection efforts."
I traded a look with Karen and could see that she was thinking the same thing I was. Nicodemus had abducted Marcone himself not so many years back as part of one of his schemes. Mab had, in fact, sent me to bail Marcone out back when I just owed her a couple of favors. I still remembered Marcone as a helpless prisoner. The image had kind of stuck in my memory. He would never forget that. There are some things money can't buy. One of them is redemption from the vengeance of gentleman Johnny Marcone. And if Karen and I went along with this plan, it would mean as much as declaring war on the Baron of Chicago.
"What do you think?" I asked her.
Karen could do the math. She knew exactly what I was talking about.
"Had to happen sometime."
I said, "Right."
"I don't get it," Binder said. "Look, if he's a man of business, why don't we just make him a proposition and cut him in for a piece of the action?"
"A valid notion," Nicodemus said, "but it is not possible."
"Why not?"
"In the first place," Nicodemus said, "the vault houses materials belonging to more persons than our principal target alone. Marcone has become something of a notoriously neutral party in the affairs of the modern supernatural world. Svartalfheim, the White Court, Dracul, and a number of other individuals of similar weight have entrusted a portion of their wealth to his keeping, and he has given his word to protect it to the best of his ability."
"That's it, then," I said to Binder. "He won't bargain. Guy's a murderous asshole, but he's good to his word." Binder settled back, frowning.
"What's the other reason, then?"
"If he let us in, it would change the nature of the place," I said before Nicodemus could answer. "We're trying to open a way into a jealously guarded vault. We probably won't be able to do it from a vault that's been opened to the public."
"Exactly," Nicodemus said. "Barring a few security systems requiring specific countermeasures, I have complete confidence that we can seize the building. Holding it until the job is done and escaping it with our hides is another matter. And that, Mr. Binder, is where you and your associates will play a critical role."
Binder grunted and leaned forward to study the map.
"How long will I need to hold it?"
"An hour at most," Nicodemus said.
Barring anyone manipulating time on us between here and there, I put in. Nicodemus gave me a sour frown and said, "We shall be finished in 1 hour, one way or the other." He pointed to a portion of the floor plans. "Here is the master vault door. That, Miss Valmont, is your responsibility." "Hang on," Binder said. "If you leave me playing doorman, how am I supposed to collect my backpack of jewels, eh? I can't go off to the Never Never and leave my lads here behind me. That'll cut the connection between us. I'm not doing this job on salary."
"I suggest your partner carry and fill 2 packs, Nicodemus said. "I will undertake to carry your pack out myself and give it to you upon my return. As I am, with the possible exception of Gray, the one most likely to survive, to escape, this arrangement would give you a greater chance of successfully receiving your payment than anyone else here."
Binder squinted at Nicodemus and sat back in his seat, obviously thinking it over.
"What do you think, Ash?"
Hannah Asher shrugged, which any red-blooded hetero male would have found utterly fascinating.
"It wasn't just me."
"If you'll trust me to pick your share, I'm willing." Binder grunted and then nodded slowly.
"I like the red ones."
"I'll remember," Asher promised. I idly scratched at an itch on the back of my neck. "So what's the big deal with Valmont cracking the door? And why drag poor Harvey into this?"
"Poor Harvey," Nicodemus said, with all the sympathy of a bullet in flight, "was our principal's factor in Chicago. He had exclusive access to the vault in question, which is kept shut by the best vault door money can buy in combination with what is known as a retina scan."
"A retina scan?" "We know what a retina scan is," Asher said impatiently. "But why do you need it? Why not just blow the vault instead of going to all the trouble of getting Gray to duplicate the guy?"
"Same deal as before," I said. "We're trying to get into a secure vault, not one that's been blown the hell open already. If we alter the place in the real world too much, we screw up the way to the one in the Never Never."
I glanced at Nicodemus and thumped a finger on the blueprint. "Our target has a private vault here?"
"Precisely. An inner security room inside the main vault. This location is one of several in which he acquires additional items for his collection by proxy," Nicodemus said.
I had to give Nick this much. He'd thought this business through, lining up like to like the way you needed to do to make magic work. "So first we have to get to the main vault?"
"Through 2 security doors, which Miss Asher will see to with a newly practiced spell," Nicodemus said. "The better not to activate the seismic sensors in the vault that will lock down the building more thoroughly and force us to take more destructive measures to gain access."
I nodded. "Then Valmont does the door on the main vault, and Gray does the private security room with the retina scan." I blinked and eyed Gray. "Right down to his retinas? Seriously?" Gray looked up from where he sat in the shadows and gave me a modest smile. I shuddered visibly. "You are an extremely creepy man," I said. I looked back at Nicodemus. "I can see a possible problem."
"Yes?"
"Marcone is not a dummy," I said. "He's gone up against supernatural powers more than once. He knows that sooner or later he and I are going to get into it. He doesn't make mistakes often, and he never fails to learn from them. He'll have supernatural precautions as well as physical ones."
"Such as?" Nicodemus asked.
"If I was him," I said, "I'd have something rigged to shut down all the electronic gizmos and close off the vault as soon as the building's power got disrupted, which just might happen when Asher and I start throwing magic around. In fact, I'd set it up to happen as soon as any amount of magic started flying."
"It would be smart," Binder said in agreement.
"Don't think it'd be too hard to fix, either. Have circuits set up around the place, something delicate that would go out without too much trouble."
"Like the ones in cell phones or something," I added. "Those things go to pieces if a wizard looks at them funny."
"Yeah," Binder said, nodding. "I can use one, but only just. Had to start keeping it powered off when I took up with Ash here." "Assuming such a wizard alarm, I suppose, exists," Nicodemus said, "how shall we defeat it?"
"Not a problem for me," Binder said. "It wouldn't even blink. These two, though, we'd have to..."
I eyed Binder sourly and rubbed at the itch on my neck again.
"Sorry, mate," he said. He sounded genuine about it. Thorn manacles, he said to Nicodemus. You know the ones?
I have some in stock, Nicodemus said. Though mine are Svartalf make, not fairy. Steel. I suppose they'll keep the talent of you and Miss Asher suppressed as much as possible. Simpler than keeping running water flowing over you both, in any case.
He gave me a small smirk when he said it. He'd once had me chained up under a freezing cold stream to prevent me from using my talents to escape or make mischief. If another good man hadn't given himself in exchange for me, I might have died there. Thorn manacles were uncommon but by no means unattainable magical bindings that accomplished the same thing, dampening a wizard's powers to the point of uselessness. And they hurt like a son of a bitch. In fact, if he had some that worked the same way but were made of steel, they were going to hurt me to an outstanding degree, given how they functioned. I returned Nicodemus's smirk with a wintry smile. Binder continued, either ignoring or not noticing the look between Nicodemus and me. Once the two of them are inside, get them into a circle before the manacles come off, Binder said. That will contain the excess energy when they work the mojo. It should help.
Hmm, Nicodemus mused. We'll have to change the entry plan. Dresden won't be able to provide a distraction. We'll have to use more, he glanced toward the Genosqua, overt means.
In the darkness, a faint gleam of yellow appeared beneath the Genosqua's eyes.
Hell's bells, the thing was smiling.
Karen shot me a look. She was thinking the same thing I was. The Genosqua wasn't going to distract anything except by ripping its head off. Depending on when we went in, God only knew how many people might be in that bank. People with absolutely no knowledge of its provenance. Even the building security forces wouldn't necessarily know they worked for the outfit. In hell, when you got right down to it, I wasn't willing to feed even a monster to something like the Genosqua at Nicodemus's behest. I rubbed at my neck again and said,
Nah, I got it still.
Excuse me, Nicodemus said.
Noisy distraction? I'll handle it. No sense showing our secret weapon early if we don't have to do it, right? Nicodemus smiled faintly.
What, wizard, without your talents?
I hadn't planned on using them anyway, I said. Could be someone was going to get hurt during this. The White Council takes a pretty dim view of magic used for that kind of thing, and I have to think about my future. You want loud and obvious? Not a problem. The Genosqua's voice came rumbling from the shadows.
He's soft.
He's smart, I said in harsh rejoinder. The harder you hit things on the way in, the harder Marcone's going to be ready to hit back on the way out. Hell, if you make a big enough stink, you'll have the cops there too. There are only about 13,000 of those guys running around Chicago, but I'm sure the 8 of us can handle them, right?
The Genosqua let out a low growl. I am not afraid of them.
Sure you aren't, I said. That's why you cruised all over the place, invisible the past 2 days, because you didn't care if you were spotted.
Gentlemen, Nicodemus said, his voice raised and slightly tense.
And then he paused, frowning, his head cocked partly to one side, as if trying to identify a distant sound. Asher suddenly looked up, frozen in the act of scratching her arm again, and said, Dresden, do you feel that? The itching on the back of my neck resolved itself into a full-on creepy sensation, the awareness of someone watching me. I closed my eyes and extended my other senses, reaching out with my talent to feel for magic in the air around me, and found the eavesdropping spell almost at once. Asher had already given us away with her comment, so there was no point in being cute about it.
Someone's listening in on us, I breathed, coming to my feet.
Where? Nicodemus spat.
Asher pointed to the far end of the slaughterhouse.
There, not far, just outside, I think.
The sensation abruptly vanished as the spell winked out of existence, but not before I'd found the spell's focus, the thaumaturgic version of the bug that had been planted so that the eavesdropper could hear us.
Binder, Nicodemus said at once.
Binder had already produced a hoop of wire from his suit coat's pocket. He moved to a clear space of floor, gave it a toss with a flick of his wrist, and the wire unreeled and unfolded into a circle almost 3 feet across. It landed on the floor even as Binder spoke a few words and filled with amber light. Binder was a chump sorcerer, but he had one trick that he could do really, really well, summoning a small army of creatures from the Never-Never that he had somehow bound to his will. It took him less than 2 seconds to whistle up the first of his suits, humanoid figures dressed in something that resembled a badly fitted suit, their proportions and features looking almost normal until one looked at them a little more closely. The demonic servitor flung itself up out of the circle like an acrobat emerging from a trapdoor in the stage, and Binder tapped his foot down onto the circle of wire in perfect time, releasing the suit from the circle's confinement as it tumbled clear. Then he lifted his foot and dropped it down again in metronomic time as a second suit emerged from the Never-Never, and a third, and a fourth, and so on. "Spell's gone," Asher reported. "He heard us. He's running."
"He's heard too much," Nicodemus said, and turned to Binder. "Can your associates track him?"
"Like bloodhounds," Binder confirmed.
Nicodemus nodded.
"Kill him."
Binder let out a short whistle and cocked a finger in the direction Asher had indicated. The suits needed no more indication than that. They bounded off in that direction with greater than human agility. I jerked my head at Karen and stalked away from the table.
"What?"
she hissed. In answer, I dug into the bandages over my arm until I found the object, hidden from me until I had finally focused my attention on it. A rounded black pente stone that had been worked into the bandages when they had been reapplied. There were a number of familiar runes painted over its dark surface in metallic gold. I'd used the exact same spell design myself more than once, back in the day, when I'd been learning how it worked.
"What's that?" Karen asked.
"The bug,"
I hissed quietly.
"The one the listener was using to hear us. It got put in the bandages over my arm when it was reset."
Her eyes widened.
"But..."
"Yeah," I said, and watched as more of the suited servitors poured forth from the Never-Never to streak into the night in pursuit.
"It's Butters. They're going to kill him."
Chapter 27
"Go," Karen said. "I'll catch up." "How are you going to find me?" She gave me a quick roll of her eyes.
"Harry, please."
Right. Karen had been a Chicago cop for 20 years. She'd find me whether I wanted her to or not. I touched her shoulder, called upon Winter, and took off at a sprint, staff clenched in my right hand. As I ran, I could feel the power of the Winter mantle infusing my body, my senses, and my thoughts. Binder's suits were hounding after the prey in a pack, moving in instinctive coordination, their leaders slowing the pace slightly until a few of the ones with a later start could catch up, the better to bring down the prey together. I caught up to the rearmost suits and passed them before I'd even exited the slaughterhouse, which sent a rush of elation through me. Slowpokes. But they were necessary. I couldn't hunt Butters down by myself. I faltered for a few steps and forced multiplication tables to start running through my head. I wasn't hunting down Butters. I was keeping them from hunting him down. And I had to figure out a way to do it without overtly turning on Nicodemus and company and shaming Mab. That particular line of reason seemed to interfere mightily with the flow of energy from the Winter Mantle, as if it simply didn't understand why it was going to all this trouble for so incomprehensible a goal.
"Butters is one of mine," I snarled at it, "and we're not letting these chumps kill him unless that's what I decide should happen."
Territory and power. Those were things that Winter could sink its teeth into. I regained my stride as we exploded from the exit of the slaughterhouse and into the near-silent mix of sleet, rain, and frozen slippery cold that was a Midwest ice storm. The ground outside the slaughterhouse was already freezing over, not in a uniform sheet, but in treacherous patches of various consistencies of nearly transparent slush, invisible ice, and wet concrete, with very few visible cues to differentiate between them. The streetlights gleamed off of all of them with benevolent cheer, and the suits started slipping at random, further slowing them. I adjusted my pace only enough to be sure of putting my feet on the least slippery option available at every stride, trusting the instincts of the mantle to guide me. Butters was sprinting across the small gravel parking lot, maybe 70 yards ahead of his pursuers. I could recognize his build and his shock of dark hair from where I was, though he was wearing a long, billowing overcoat and a rather bulgy-looking backpack and moving more slowly than he should have been. In the lowering skies, the mixed rain and lumpy snow, the sound seemed muffled and close, as if everything was happening indoors. I could hear Butters's quick, clean breaths, his pants of effort as he slowed, nearing the street. I hoped he was about to throw himself into a getaway car. Instead, he fumbled at his backpack and spun in a comical circle, trying to pull something off of it. As he whirled beneath the yellow cone of illumination cast by a streetlight, I saw him take a wide-looking skateboard off where it had been fastened to the pack and slam it to the concrete. "You've got to be kidding me," I muttered. "A freaking skateboard?" The suits saw it and surged ahead. I'd seen them move before, and they could pounce like mountain lions. They'd be within a long leap of him in seconds. Butters threw a glance over his shoulder, his face pale, his eyes huge behind his glasses, and stepped hard onto the skateboard, setting it into motion. He fumbled with a short strap on the front of the board, crouching and taking hold of it with the same intensity as a water skier about to be launched into motion.
"Go! Go! Go!"
he screamed. And then a small inferno of orange sparks erupted from the wheels of the skateboard, and the damn thing took off down the empty street at the speed of a motorcycle. I felt my jaw drop open for a second, and then a bubbling chuckle rolled up out of my chest. Butters, it seemed, had been using more of my old artifice spells, doubtless learned from Bob the Skull. That particular one looked an awful lot like the one I'd put together in my one ill-advised attempt to create a wizardly classic, a flying broomstick. The experiment had damn near killed me and scared me enough that I abandoned its use until I had a better understanding of the aerodynamics involved, but I'd never even considered applying it to something that wouldn't necessarily flip me upside down while in motion and carry me into buildings at suicidal speeds. Why had I never applied the same magic to a freaking bicycle? Or to a skateboard? Butters didn't have the kind of power it took to be even a serious sorcerer, but the little guy had knocked together a number of useful magical tools over the past couple of years, also with Bob's help, and it looked like those exercises had developed into a real gift for creating magical artifices. But how the hell was he powering the damn things? Wizardly tools like that were like toys that needed batteries to work, but Butters didn't have the strength to power any but the simplest toys, so what was he using as a battery? Oh. Oh, no. The suits let out howls of excitement and began lengthening their strides. They weren't done, not by a long shot, and they started curling the path of their pursuit, bounding over the fence surrounding the property, leaping over the landscaping of nearby buildings. I went with them, leaping the same fences. One of the suits slipped and hit the chain link at better than 30 miles an hour, with moderately gruesome results. Another suit might have accidentally caught the end of my quarterstaff in the teeth as we both leapt a 6-foot hedge and wound up slamming into the side of an office building at the same pace. But it was pretty dark, what with the rain and sleet and snow and all, and I just wasn't entirely sure what happened. By the time we hit the next cross street, I saw Butters fling out an arm. There was another glint of orange sparks, this time in a long line, and I saw some kind of dark fiber whip out from his hand and wrap around a streetlight's pole. He leaned into it with a high-pitched, half-panicked whoop of excitement and used the line to carry the racing skateboard through a tight 90-degree turn without slowing down. There was another sparkle of orange campfire sparks along the length of the line, and the thing evidently let go of the pole as he kept sailing down the street, heading north. Suits were letting out hunting cries at regular intervals by now, and running unimpeded on streets that were still warm enough from the day's light to resist the ice. I knew that Binder could probably have 40 or 50 of the damn things on the street by now, and that they were smart enough to communicate and work cooperatively. I had to hope that Butters would have the good sense to continue heading in one direction. Every turn in the chase would give his more numerous pursuers a chance to maneuver, closing in around him like hounds around a panicked rabbit. He kept fleeing down the street, but the smooth surface that let him use his and I can't believe I'm going to use this phrase, enchanted skateboard, also gave an advantage to his pursuers. The street was still warm enough from the sunlight of the day, and the passage of early evening traffic meant that the falling precipitation had been given less time to settle, and consequently ice had not yet begun to clog it. The suits and I began to close the distance, and I couldn't act to discourage them in the excellent lighting without risking observation. Then came what I had feared might happen. A pair of suits, maybe a little leaner and faster than their companions, vectored in on the chase from a side street, using the cries of their companions to coordinate their attack. They bounded forward in a rush, and it was only because Butters had his left leg forward and so was facing them as they came that he saw them close on him. I'll give the little guy credit. He didn't panic. Instead, he dropped his free hand into his coat, seized something, and smashed it to the street in his wake, shouting a word as he did. There was a flash of light on some kind of glass globe, and then it shattered on the concrete, expanding into a cloud of thick gray mist just in front of his pursuers. The two suits hit the mist, unable to avoid it in their surge of closing speed, and plunged into it and out the other side, where their steps abruptly slowed, and the pair of them stumbled to a halt, looking around them blearily as Butters and his orange-sparking skateboard whooshed on down the street. As the rest of the pack passed the spot, the suits dodged around the cloud of gray mist, and the two who had stopped gave their packmates a startled, confused look, and then took off in belated pursuit again, obviously straining to catch up. That was when I realized what I'd just seen, and I went by the cloud of mist, cackling madly. Mind fog. Better than 10 years ago, a foe had used the enchanted mist to blanket an entire Walmart store, rendering the memory of everyone inside it temporarily non-functional and effectively blurring the previous hour or so of experience beyond recall. Bob and I had worked out the specifics of how the spell must have operated in the aftermath of the case. Obviously, Butters and Bob had, between them, figured out how to can the stuff. Butters rocketed on down the street, dodging around a couple of slow-moving cars, used his light pole lariat again twice in quick succession, and careened onto Michigan Avenue, heading into the heart of downtown, where the towers and lights of Chicago burned brightest in the freezing haze. That gave even the demonic suits pause. Cities aren't just streets and buildings. They are collectives of sheer will, of the determination of every person who helped build them and every soul whose work and life maintains them. To something from the Never Never, a place like downtown Chicago is an alien citadel, a source of power and terror. Mordor, basically. One does not simply walk into Mordor, except that's exactly what everyone in the story did anyway. Similarly, Binder's goons were not sufficiently impressed with the loop to let it stop them from pursuing Butters. They put on a surge of speed and gained on him, and for a moment it looked like they might nab him again. But he hurled a second glass globe of forget-me-mist to the street and disrupted the pursuit at exactly the right moment. Butters let out a shriek of terrified defiance and shook his fist at his pursuers as several staggered in confusion, stumbling into their packmates. Then the Janosqua appeared out of nowhere on the sidewalk in front of a cafe and kicked a stone planter the size of a hot tub directly into Butters's path. Butters had maybe a whole second to react and nowhere near enough time to steer around the planter. The Janosqua had acted with calm, precise timing. Butters did the only thing he could do. He let go of the skateboard strap and leapt into the air. He wasn't wearing padding, and he didn't have a helmet. That dopey little skateboard had been moving at 30 miles an hour, and all that waited to receive him was cold asphalt. If he'd been in a car with an airbag, I'm sure he'd have been fine, but he wasn't. I ground my teeth and prepared a spherical shield to catch him with. But while that would protect him from the fall, it would also mean that he could be briefly held inside it until his momentum was spent. Without the skateboard, the suits, or the Janosqua would catch him in a few heartbeats, and I would be forced to fight to defend him, bringing my mission to an unfortunate conclusion. So be it. You don't leave friends, even friends twisted up with mistrust, to the monsters. But instead of falling onto the street and splattering, or into my shield and getting us both subsequently killed, Butters's too billowy overcoat flared with orange sparks and spread out into a giant cupped wing shape. He windmilled his arms and legs with a high-pitched, creaking shout, and then tucked himself into a ball while the orange light seemed to gather the coat into a resilient sphere around him. One that bounced once when it hit the street, and then rolled several times, dumping him onto the street more or less on his feet. The little guy darted straight away from the Junosqua, for which I did not blame him, up the steps of the nearest building, as it happened the Art Institute of Chicago. The nearest of the suits leapt at his unprotected back. I flung my staff forward with a howl of, "Forzare!" and smashed the suit with invisible power in midair, flinging him just over Butters' shoulder as he leapt.
"Damn it!"
I howled with as much sincerity as I could muster, which wasn't much.
"Clear my line of fire!"
Butters shot an aghast look over his shoulder at me and stumbled away, fetching up against the northernmost of the two lion statues outside the Art Institute. He darted a look at the statue, licked his lips, and hissed something beneath his breath. Orange light flooded out of the inner folds of his coat and promptly seeped into the bronze of the statue, confirming how he was managing all of these tricks. Bob. Bob the Skull was running around loose like some kind of bloody superhero sidekick. Bob had been the one powering the skateboard. Bob had guided the ropes that had flown from Butters's wrist. Bob had manipulated Butters's coat to bring him into a safe landing. Damn, Bob was kind of awesome. It only stood to reason. Though Bob was a spirit, he had always been able to manipulate physical objects. And if he had mostly only done so with fairly small, fairly light things in the past, like romance novels or his own skull, there was no reason that I knew that he might not have tried something larger. I'd always assumed he simply lacked the motivation. But I'd rarely removed Bob from my lab for a reason. To be exercising that kind of control over the spirit, Butters had to be in possession of Bob's skull, like right now. He was actually carrying the skull around, probably in that backpack, and that meant that Bob's allegiance was as fragile as Butters' ability to remain in physical possession of the skull itself. If someone like Nicodemus got hold of the skull, with Bob's centuries of experience and knowledge, I shuddered to think what my old friend might be used to accomplish. Of course, that concern abruptly dwindled to a secondary issue as I realized what Butters had commanded the spirit to do. Orange firelight sparks suddenly erupted from the eyes of the enormous bronze lion. Then, moving exactly as if it had been a living beast, the thing turned its head toward me, crouched, and let out an enormous and authentically leonine roar. "Oh, crap," I said.
"Hold them off!"
Butters shouted. The lion roared again. "Damn it, Butters," I snarled under my breath. "I'm helping." And then several tons of living bronze predator, guided by the intelligence and will of the most powerful spirit of intellect I had ever encountered, flung itself directly at my head. Chapter 28. It had been a good long while since I'd had a freaking lion coming at me, and at the time it had been one of the genuine flesh and blood variety from the zoo. I'd never had something made entirely of metal try to kill me before, unless you counted the instruments of the occasional would-be vehicular homicide that came my way, and never both at the same time, so actually that made this a first. And that's important in a job. Fresh challenges, what would I do without them? Without the winter mantle on my side, I think Bob might have taken my head off of my shoulders. But instead, I ducked, fast enough and low enough to avoid the enormous paw that flashed toward me in anticipation of the move, and Bob flew over me, crashing into a pair of binder suits with juggernaut enthusiasm. They went flying like ninepins, and the bronze lion whirled toward me, far too fast for something so massive, and crouched to leap at me again. And one of the lion's golden-orange glowing eyes, the one away from the street, shivered down in the barest little wink imaginable. Bob got it. My former lab assistant thundered,
"Die, traitor!"
and then roared again.
"Watch out! He's loose!"
I screamed to a nearby suit, reeling back toward him and fighting to keep the sudden grin off my face.
"He'll tear us all apart! Rawr!"
Bob screamed and came rushing at me again. I flung myself to one side at the last second when the suit wouldn't see Bob coming until it was too late. The bronze lion smashed into the suit, sending it tumbling in a whirl of broken limbs to smash into the side of the Art Institute. It exploded into gelatinous clear goo, its physical vessel simply too mangled to enable the spirit Binder had summoned to continue animating it, and the lion let out a roar of triumph and turned toward the next nearest suits.
"I'll get him!"
I shouted. I pointed my staff at Bob and snarled,
"Fuego!"
A blast of pure fire erupted from the staff, missed the rampaging lion statue by inches, and took a pair of suits full on, setting them ablaze and causing them to issue weird howls of frustration and rage as it began to consume their physical forms. Furious, the burning suits flung themselves at Bob, and the hunting pack mentality of the demons prompted the others to leap at the rampaging statue as well. Bob roared, his eyelights blazing merrily, and started batting them around like Mister playing with multiple catnip lures on a string. I hopped back from the immediate vicinity of the havoc and looked around wildly for Butters. I checked his last direction but saw nothing, except an empty plastic sports drink bottle rolling slowly down the sidewalk, pushed by the mild wind coming in from the north. Exactly like the kind I'd used to store a potion in when I made one. Butters was in the wind. Hell, maybe literally. It had been a long time since I'd brewed that escape potion that had saved me from a toad demon, but if I'd had a 20, I'd have betted against a piece of bubblegum that Butters had duplicated my old formula and used it to pull a quick vanishing act in the confusion. Because confusion there was. The explosions and roaring and noise had done exactly what I'd hoped they would and attracted attention. Though the muffling effect of the weather had dulled the sounds, and though it was well after business hours, that didn't mean that the area around us was wholly empty of life. Lights had begun to flick on, faces had begun to appear at windows in nearby buildings. One of the cardinal points of common sense in the supernatural world is that you don't get yourself involved with mortal authorities. The average individual mortal, or 20, might not be a match for a real supernatural predator. I'm pretty sure the serious bad guys, like the hulking, hairy one standing in the shadows across the street from the Art Institute, could take on a riot's worth of mortals without hesitation and expect victory. But in a city like Chicago, starting a rumble with humanity wouldn't mean fighting a score of mortals or a couple of hundred. It would mean thousands, and more important, it would mean tangling with those who had the training and equipment to be a genuine threat. People had actually begun to appear on the street from inside the cafe and a nearby sandwich shop. Cell phones were coming out. And Chicago PD had maybe half a dozen stations within a mile of where I stood.
"What are you waiting for?"
I shouted toward the Janosqua and pointed at the animated statue.
"Lend a hand, big guy!"
The Janosqua glowered at me for a second and then at the rampaging Bob. There was a flash of ugly yellow tusks, a glitter of malicious and angry eyes, and then the creature faded from sight, turning as it vanished and starting up the street in the direction Butters had last been going. Worse, there was a sound of rushing wind overhead, and something dark and swift passed between me and some of the higher lights in the area, sending a multitude of wavering, flickering shadows across the street. I squinted up into the rain and mist and saw nothing but a large, winged form moving fast in the same direction. Well, crap.
Nicodemus and Anduriel had taken to the air. I had no doubt that the Junosqua could track Butters as well as any hound, and that escape potion, if that's what he used, would only transport him a relatively short distance, maybe a couple of blocks. It would be only a matter of time before Nicodemus spotted Butters or the Junosqua picked up his trail, and he no longer had Bob to propel his skateboard or cover his back. I ground my teeth, and Bob sent another one of Binder's suits flying past me. I ducked absently. My instincts told me to get moving again as quickly as possible. I told him to shut the hell up. I could go sprinting off in some direction, but that was unlikely to result in accomplishing anything. I took a moment to lever the winter mantle away from my thoughts and found them clearer. The winter night was not needed here. I ran down the street to the discarded sports bottle and snagged it. Just as I did, one of those mini SUVs sliced through the slush in the middle of the avenue, sliding only slightly to one side as it braked, and Karen stuck her head out the window. "Get in!" I ran for the vehicle as Karen stared in fascination at the sight of more than a dozen suits swarming over the lion, struggling to overturn it, and the huge thing twisting and spinning like a dervish trying to keep them off, orange eye lights blazing. "Huh," Karen said. "That's new." I slammed the door shut and said, "It's Bob. Butters let him off the chain." "Is that good?" she asked. I stuffed my staff mostly into the back and fumbled with the bottle. "It's exciting, anyway. Butters gave them the slip, but Nicodemus and the Junosqua are on his trail." "Is our cover blown?" "Not yet," I said. "We're still bad guys. At least enough to satisfy Mab. You know how confusing fights can be." "Ha!" Karen said. "What's the plan?" "Find Butters. Get me to somewhere I can step out of the rain and give me a second to get a tracking spell running." "No need," she said and started driving. "I know where he's going." I blinked. "Where?" "You're Butters. You know basically everything that's been going on in Chicago for the past dozen years. You've got a bunch of demons and supernatural bad guys, including the Knights of the Blackened Denarius, after you," she said. "Where would you go?" I frowned, thinking. She was right about that. If Butters had been working that closely with Bob, he'd know pretty much anything the Skull did, and he'd recognize Deirdre and Nicodemus by name. Hell, he must have, which probably explained his mistrust. I'd declined to tell him anything about what I'd gotten Karen into, and he'd listened in on me spending a day with a bunch of super criminals and sitting down at a table with Nicodemus Arc Leone. And where in this city would be the best place to go if one wanted protection from fallen angels? "Hell's bells," I breathed. "He's going to Michael's." "Yeah," Karen said, real anger in her voice. "Damn it, he knows better." I blinked several times and then felt my jaw drop as a flash of intuition hit me. "The swords are there, aren't they? And Butters knows it." Her jaw tensed. She eyed me and gave me a single short nod. "I wanted one other person to know, in case something happened to me. My place isn't secure enough, even with what the Paranetters can do, and I'm sure as hell not going to trust those things to Marcone's people. Anything bad that tries to get into Michael's place has got a world of hurt coming down. It was the best I could think of." "If they catch Butters before he gets there," I said, "he's dead. If you're wrong about where he's going, he's dead. And if we stop for a couple of minutes for you to get your mojo together, we might get there too late to do anything," she said and bit her lip. She was coaxing as much speed from the little truck as she could in this weather, its all-wheel drive churning steadily. "What do you think we should do?" This was my fault. If I'd brought Butters in, at least far enough to understand what was going on, he wouldn't have gone poking around himself. But damn it, how could I have done it without... Ah! I hated this cards close to the chest thing. I suck at cards. I'm more of a Monopoly sort of guy. "I hadn't talked to Michael in years," I said. "The first day I do, I set off a chain of events that has some heavyweight monsterage heading right for his house." "Yeah," Karen said, "I noticed that." "Maybe it isn't a coincidence," I said. She arched one pale brow. "Faith, Harry? You?" "Oh, blow me," I said, scowling. "Drive." She bared her teeth in a fierce smile and said, "Buckle up." I did, as the fine, freezing rain began to turn to heavy sleet. Chapter 29. We were two blocks from Michael's place, back in the residential neighborhoods, when a cab all but teleported out of the sleet, moving too fast. It rolled through a stop sign and forced Karen to slam on the brakes and swerve to avoid a collision. The little SUV did its best, but it slid on the sleet-slickened street, bounced over the curb, through a wooden privacy fence, and wound up with its front wheels in someone's emptied pool. Karen slapped the vehicle into reverse and tried to pull out, but the rear tire spun uselessly on the ice.
"Damn it," she snarled. "Go! I'm right behind you."
I grabbed my staff and leapt out into the sleet without hesitating, wrapping myself in winter as I went running through the storm and into the hazy pseudo-darkness. I went straight for Michael's place, sprinting down a sidewalk briefly and then cutting through yards, bounding over fences and parked cars, parkour, as I went. I got to the carpenter's home just as the cab that had caused our wreck slid to a gradual stop a few houses past Michael's. Butters popped out of the back and threw several wadded bills at the driver, then put his head down and sprinted toward Michael's house. He looked pale and shaky. I sympathized. That potion had left me feeling like I'd just ridden a couple of dozen roller coasters all at once with a bad hangover. He hadn't run 5 steps before one of his feet went out from under him on the frozen, slippery sidewalk, and he went down hard. I heard his head rap the concrete, and then felt a sympathetic pang at the explosion of air from his lungs as the fall knocked the wind out of him. I didn't slow down until I was close to Butters, sweeping my gaze around the neighborhood and finding it quiet and still.
"Jesus!"
Butters blurted out as I got close. He flinched away from me, raising one hand as if to ward off a blow, reaching for something inside his coat with the other.
"Hell's bells, Butters," I said on a note of complaint. "If I was going to hurt you, I'd have blasted you from way the hell over there." "You tried," he wheezed, hand still poised inside his coat. "Stay back. I mean it."
"Hell's bells, you are smarter than this," I sighed and offered him my hand.
"Come on, they're bound to be right behind you. You can't stay out here. Let me help you up."
He stared up at me for a second, clearly a little dazed from the fall and just as obviously terrified. I made an impatient clucking sound and stepped forward. Butters fumbled what looked like a glass Christmas ornament from his coat's inner pocket and flicked it at me weakly. Winter was still upon me. I bent my knees a little and caught it on the fly, careful not to break it.
"Whoa," I said. "Easy there, killer. I'd rather not have us both forget why we're standing out here in the sleet."
He stared up at me, struggling to draw a steady breath.
"Harry?"
"Easy," I said. "Here." I passed the ornament back to him. He blinked at me.
"Come on," I said.
I bent down, got a hand under his arm, and more or less hauled the little guy to his feet. He slipped again at once and would have fallen if I hadn't held him up. I steadied him, guiding his steps off the treacherous concrete and onto the grass in front of one of the houses.
"There, easy. Come on, let's get you out of the cold at least."
He groaned and said,
"Oh God, Harry, you're not... You haven't..."
We stumbled a few more steps, and then he said,
"I'm an idiot. I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry," I said, looking around us warily. "Be inside."
"How bad have I screwed things up?" he asked.
"We move fast enough, nothing that can't be fixed," I said. Impatient, I ducked down enough to get a shoulder beneath his arm, and more or less lifted him up, dragging him along with his feet barely touching the ground toward the carpenter's yard. 20 yards. 10. 5. The wind rushed. Something shaped like black sails billowed in the sleet. And then swirling shadow receded, and Nicodemus Arcleone stood between us and safety, a slender bladed sword held in his right hand, blade parallel with his leg. He faced me with a small smile. Behind him, his shadow stretched out for 20 yards in every direction, writhing in slow waves. I drew up short. Butters' leg swung back and forth. I took a step back and looked over my shoulder. The Janosqua blurred into vision through the thick sleet, maybe 20 feet back, staying in the shadows of a large pine tree.
his enormous shaggy form blending into its darkness. I could see the gleam of his eyes, though.
Ah, Dresden, Nicodemus purred. You caught him, and in the nick of time.
I set Butters down warily and kept him close to my side. The little guy didn't move or speak, though I could feel him shuddering with sudden, intelligent terror.
The little doctor, Nicodemus said. Quite a resourceful rabbit, is he not?
He's quick, I said, and not much of a threat. There's no reason not to let him go.
Don't be absurd, Nicodemus said. He's heard entirely too much, and my files on him say that he's been associated with Marcone's Chicago alliance. Only an idiot wouldn't recognize a potentially lethal security leak.
He tilted his head to one side.
He dies.
The Junosqua let out a hungry, rumbling growl. Butters stiffened. He did not look behind him. I didn't blame him. I didn't want to look back there either. Nicodemus was enjoying this.
It seems, Dresden, he said, that it is time for you to make a choice. Shall I make it easier for you?
What'd you have in mind? I asked.
Practicality, Nicodemus said. Give him to me. I will take him from here. It will be quick and merciful.
His eyes shifted to Butters.
It's nothing personal, young man. You became involved in something larger than you. That is the price you pay. But I've no grudge with you. You will simply stop.
Butters made a quiet, terrified sound.
Or, Nicodemus said, you can breach Mab's given word, wizard.
He smiled.
In which case, well, I have no need of you.
Without me, I said, you'll never get through the second gate.
Once I kill you, Nicodemus said, I'm quite certain Mab will loan me her next knight or another servant as readily as she did you, if it means a chance to make good on her word. Choose.
I'm thinking about it, I said. Nicodemus opened one hand, a gracious gesture, inviting me to take my time. Giving him Butters wasn't on the table, period. But fighting him did not seem like a good idea either. With Nicodemus on one side and the Junosqua on the other, I did not like my chances at all. Even with the Winter Knight's mantle, I didn't know if I could have beaten either of these guys, let alone both of them at once. If I gave him Butters, I might live. If I didn't, both of us were going to die, right here next door to Michael's house. I was out of options.
You take the guy behind us, I muttered to Butters.
The little guy swallowed and jerked his head in a tiny nod, gripping his Christmas ornament carefully. Nicodemus nodded, his dark eyes glittering. The point of the slender sword swept up, lithe as a snake's flickering tongue, and his shadow began to dance and waver in sudden agitation. The Junosqua let out another rumbling growl and stepped forward. I gripped my staff, and Butters' tremors abruptly stilled into an electrified tension. And then Karen stepped out of the sleet with her rocket launcher, prepped and resting on her shoulder, aimed directly at Nicodemus. Hi, she said. I really don't like you very much, Denarian.
Ha!
I said to Nicodemus.
Heh heh.
His eyes slid from me to Karen and back. His smile widened.
Ms. Murphy, he said, you won't shoot.
Why not? Karen asked brightly.
Because it is obvious to me that you love him, Nicodemus said. That weapon will kill the wizard, as well as your friend the doctor, if you fire it. At that range, I'm not at all certain that you would survive the blast either.
Karen seemed to regard that offering thoughtfully. Then she said, You're right, and took several steps closer. There, that should just about do it, don't you think? Nicodemus narrowed his eyes.
You wouldn't.
Karen spoke in a very low, very calm voice. People do crazy things for love. I'd rather kill us all and take you with us than let you harm him. Her voice became a bit sharper, and she took another pair of quick strides nearer Nicodemus. Take one step closer, tall, dark, and furry, and I blow us all to hell right now. I checked over my shoulder to see the Janosqua pause in the act of slipping a little closer. Its cavern eyes glittered in silent rage. Karen took a couple of slow steps toward Nicodemus, her eyes strangely bright.
Crazy, crazy things. Don't push me.
Nicodemus's smile turned into a smirk.
You proceed from a false assumption, he said. You assume that your toy can actually threaten me or my companion.